Changes in sexual performance are more common than most people realize, and support doesn't need to feel awkward. With MedExpress, everything happens privately online. Start by completing a short consultation reviewed by UK-registered clinicians. If eligible, treatment is delivered discreetly to your home, with ongoing support whenever you need it. You're not alone in this. Visit medexpress.co.uk/podcast to learn more.
You know what I was most nervous about was on SNL was the stand-up, the monologue.
Oh, really?
That was, you know, that's the thing you're supposed to be good at.
Yeah, so right.
That had the most pressure. The other stuff, I went into it that weekend and I just told myself, I go, just commit to everything. It's actually, you will look more stupid if you don't commit. So if you're trying not to look stupid and you don't want to feel embarrassed, well, committing is the only way to not feel that.
Hey everyone, welcome to How Success Happens. I'm Dan Bova, writer and editor at entrepreneur.com. Today's guest is one of the funniest human beings on the planet. And I know comedians hate to get introduced like that, but I'm sorry, Nate, it's true. And I will not lie to the How Success Happens audience. Nate Bargatze has sold millions of tickets touring. He's hosted Saturday Night Live, the Emmys, wrote a book, hosts the greatest average American game show, and will be making his feature film debut on May 29th in the movie The Breadwinner. Everybody, welcome the extremely lazy and mildly successful Nate Bargatze.
Yeah, thank you. That's what I wanted. That sets me up right.
That's right. I hope I'm a big fan of yours, and I love speaking with comedians because I like a good chuckle, but because, as I've said a bunch of times, you are the ultimate entrepreneurs. You are the founder, you're the chief content officer, you're the product. And a lot of people struggle with the confidence to launch that product. So I'm wondering, what helped you in your earliest days to have that confidence to go for it?
Yeah, obsession. You know what's funny is I like that you said it like that, because I say that a lot in the fact that comedians, like I want to encourage comedians, the younger comedians, to be like, it's a talent, it's what you work at, is to be, you have to be everything. Direct, produce, write. It's all on you. And so I think comics, that's why they can be very versatile. And that's why you saw old school comics like Billy Crystal and like Don Rickles, like all these guys that could do many different kinds of things, because you can put a comic in any situation. Yeah. And they're gonna be able to entertain. They're creators. So it's I even see it more now than I did back then. Back then, you're just obsessed with stand-up. And, you know, when I first started, and you just want to just do good. You're trying to figure out the next joke. You're trying to make that crowd laugh every night. You're just kind of really obsessed whether you got to do it all day. I mean, not all day, but at the shows all day. You're thinking about it 24/7. It just doesn't leave your mind. And so that's really where you're around other people that are doing it. And you see people get stuck too, because some people don't. If they quit, right? If you're not always trying to find the next joke, that's when you kind of get
right
stalled out.
So, did in those early days, were you the Nate that we know now, or did this kind of evolve? Did you hit open mics fully formed? How did that all happen?
No, it's I wouldn't. I mean, no one would have predicted to be where I was at right now. To be honest, I think I thought I would, I believed in myself a lot, whether I didn't like outwardly say that to anybody. And then my act is also so self-deprecating.
Yeah.
But I mean, I did believe in myself a little bit. Like, you know, I would, when I first started, I was in New York, and I would hand out flyers on the street trying to get stage time. And I would daydream about playing like kind of Bridgestone Arena, the arena in Nashville. And so, you know, it took me 20 years. And then I did it. But that was like, you know, that was like my day. Like, I never mentioned it to anybody. I just kind of, you just fantasize it. But I think I would think about it so much that when I was there and I did it, it was like, yeah, I mean, I kind of thought I would do it because it's in your mind every day.
Yeah, that's great. And, it's funny because I went to NYU in the 90s and I think about walking past the Boston Comedy Club and someone's trying to give me a flyer to go. And I'm like, it's all right, buddy. I don't need your little silly jokes. And it was probably you or like John Mulaney or some like crazy, hilarious person. I'm like, nah, I'm going to get a falafel. I don't need your jokes.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was Boston Comedy Club.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm curious too, you've talked about this, but, when you were starting out, did you get any advice about your act that you're kind of in retrospect really glad that you ignored? Was anyone trying to steer you in a different direction for more like those late night crowds?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if they steered me. I remember one time I had someone tell me I should change my last name. And they were like, it's never going to work out with that last name. And so I remember, you would get I think you would just get shots like that. That would, whether they even were serious or not serious or whatever, but you would contemplate. And you get a lot of things that you could see could get influenced. I mean, doing all the shows that I did when I first started, I was friends with, most of my friends were like pretty dirty comics. So I was on a lot of midnight shows that were edgy shows. And I moved to New York and I started in 03, but I moved to New York in 2004. And so that was when, the edgy was kind of coming up, everybody was kind of being edgy was kind of the hot thing. Mm-hmm. And so being clean was just, I don't know, just wasn't as rewarded as edgy for just because of the time being. And so I would do all those late shows and just have to be clean during those late shows. But, you would get, you would feel like, man, am I just sitting here doing nothing or nothing's happening? Or even when people got political and that became that you could feel like you're getting swayed to be like, well, should I go that route, should I do this? You're just trying to look for anything to jump start to really make you have that leap. I was like, I need to just stay my lane and see how it goes. And it worked out in the sense that it took 20 years. It's like, I've done everything. Mm-hmm. I've done every bad show you could ever do. I've done every comedy club. I've done every theater in every city in America. I've done every arena. Now I've done all their arenas. So you just you're how much experience I have now versus if I would have done something to veer me off in a different path.
Right.
It would have been a huge mistake for me. And so
as a comedian and so much of your act is, just these dumb things, these annoyances that happen to us. But I would imagine with some degree of success that you've had, there's some degree of friction that leaves your life. And I'm wondering, well, A, is that true? But also, when something annoying does happen, are you just like, yes, I have something to talk about?
Yeah. I mean, you're always looking. Like Seinfeld said it the best, where it's like you almost like a comedian's always got like a third eye that's just kind of hovering above every situation, just seeing what you can grab. And you just sit on it and you wait for it. And I don't feel like jokes rarely come or stories come where it's like the thing happens and then you immediately put it on stage and it works. It's usually, when people ask, they go, oh, I'll bet you're going to get a lot of material out of tonight. And you're like, I might. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's going to be as quick as you think it is.
Right.
I got to sit and it might be 5 years later and then it fits into something. So there's a lot of that. You're just kind of always gathering.
Right.
And then you just, when you write a new hour, you just you try to find some staples that you want, and then you can grab these things from other experiences in life.
And I think that's such great advice too, in that you have these nuggets of something good and there's this temptation to want to just keep putting stuff out there, but you have this confidence to hold on to this for a minute, wait a beat, because this is going to be better in a year from now when it fits with this other thing?
I've always been very protective of my act. And I, you know, when comics would put ideas out on social media, Twitter, especially when Twitter was like first going, you know, a lot of comics would throw a lot of jokes out there. And I never wanted to put anything that I would put in my act out there. I was like protective, because it's almost like the act is what is the,
yeah,
the success is like, I gotta, you know, like keep this to myself. I can't just give it out
right
in this other way. So you just kind of hold everything back. I think you see that a lot with the young comics now, where they're just handing out material and you're like, man, or they tell a story on a podcast and, you know, there's stories you can tell on a podcast that you know won't fit in your act. But then there's times where like someone will tell a story on a podcast and you're like, dude, that story you could have closed.
Right.
Why would you give that away on a podcast? You should put it in your act. I mean,
yeah.
I'm a big believer of an act, and you know, and I think that works in every out form of anything, business, anything. If you can sit and you know you have an act, it's like you can just kind of go wherever you want, because you know you have something. You're not like trying to figure something out on the fly. You're
right.
Got a thing that I know I'm doing that I've been working on.
So a lot of people in all areas of business talk about embracing failure. It always sounds great to embrace failure, but in the moment it sucks. Anyone who's failed at something. And I'm wondering, do you have any spectacular, you know, bombing on stage stories or something that ended up being actually instructive or helpful to you after the fact?
I remember I did when I was first starting, there was a comic, and so there was this guy used to book all these fire halls in New Jersey. And so it was like, I remember wanting to get on them because like you could, you know, they paid $200 or something. And so you're just trying to get, you know, you're trying to pick up, that's what you did a lot of spots in the city, but then you would try to find some like little one night gigs like that you could go do and make a little money. And so I remember doing a show. And we go to this fire hall. We're in where they keep the fire engines, the trucks. So it's like very echoey. It's, you know, and I have this act, like, you know, I'm low energy. I'm all this stuff. And so I go up, and I remember I had a joke about Shakespeare. This is a long time ago, where Shakespeare invented words. I can't remember the exact, but like, so like it'd be a nightmare to be friends with Shakespeare, because I forget a word. He would just say a word and you're like, what's that word? He's like, I just made it up. We're going to start using it now. So it'd be annoying to be friends with Shakespeare. And so I do that joke in the fire hall. Let's just say it didn't go great. That's not where Shakespeare material is going to fly. And then, so I have my, so I like bomb. I remember the guy that booked it. He came up to me and he goes, "Does that Shakespeare joke work in the city?" And I go, and I was like, "Yeah." And he just goes, and walked away from me. And then the guy I was with goes up and he like would do kind of some prop stuff. And so it just destroys. And I'm on board with prop stuff. I'm not saying it doesn't. He played the trumpet, actually. And so he played the trumpet. And he would do a funny thing with the trumpet. And it was so funny. And it destroyed in that fire hall. So then we're driving back to the city. And I was just like, man, you killed the show tonight. Dude. That was like so awesome to get to see. You know, I mean, I bombed hard. But I was like, it was fun to get to watch you do it. And then he just quietly, he goes, you know what? I don't think you're supposed to do good in those types of rooms. And that was all he said. And then we didn't really talk much till we got, but it was like such a surreal moment to, you know, it's like something I learn. And like, it was a very honest moment where you would learn that you go, even though I want to do good in that room. But it's like that situation, you kind of learn that you want to go, even him at that moment, just being like, yeah, I don't think you're supposed to, I don't think that's where you're supposed to be the best at.
Oh yeah. My God, that's hilarious. Holy cow. So in your act, you know, you present yourself as this someone who struggles with common everyday chores, like ordering food deliveries and things like that. And you've talked about this big idea for an amusement park called Nateland. So my question is, are you qualified to do that, Nate?
I mean, no. I'm not. I just go. No one's telling me no, though. So I just keep going. No one, like, it's like, trust me, I'm looking for someone to tell me no. Every idea I have, I want someone to say, no, you can't do that. Now we have a lot of people that are qualified and know what they're doing. And so you see that they need they need the vision. They need again, you go back to the creator. Like, you have to be that aspect. You know, Walt Disney was a creator. And I always think of it like Walt Disney could walk into any room and put on some type of show, even though he wasn't a comedian, he wasn't anything. But he could tell stories or he could do something. He just had a mind for that thing of a creator. And I think when you see that as stuff, as any company or as anything gets started, the farther you get removed from a creator is the less the passion, the less, I don't know, it just becomes like a different thing. And I'm not talking about Disney. Disney's still doing great. I'm talking about in general. And so you see that when you're, you know, as someone that has to create, because IP is something everybody talks about, especially in the business world, is it's IP. You got to find IP. And I think as a, you know, especially as a comedian, you realize that you're like, oh, I have IP. Mm. My whole life is IP.
Right.
Every job, I have 7 hours of stand-up specials. That's IP. And that seems to be the thing that all the companies or all the big, that's what they want the most is the, that's the hardest thing for them to come up with. So weirdly, like artists are sitting on the thing that makes everything kind of go in a sense.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know if, you know, they all realize that, but it's like, you know, you just sit there and go like, yeah, I have the IP, which is able to let me sit and just go like, I can decide what I want to, who I want to give that to.
Mm.
You know, I mean, you're giving it away a lot of it when you first start because you don't really realize it. I mean, you're not thinking like this.
Yeah.
And then as I've gotten older and, you know, it's like that's where the idea of a theme park went is like you have all this stuff. You have all this IP that you can, where can it go live? Where can it go sit? Where can it go, you know? Where can I use it to come up with new stuff?
I love that too, because it's like, as you said, the idea is coming from you. And then I'm imagining, you tell me if I'm wrong, but now you find some people that like maybe know about acquiring land, maybe know about building roller coasters and the legal aspects of that. So you're staying focused on what you do. And then you're getting people to do the stuff that you don't.
Yeah. There's many things. I mean, my CEO or business partner that runs my company, Felix Vertigets, he was a partner at KPMG. We live in the same cul-de-sac and just very, very smart, ran a lot of big deals through KPMG, did a lot of crazy stuff. And when I, one day it's like, I like to, you know, not everybody that works for me, I have like a connection to. But like, there's a lot of them like somewhat you can have a connection to, like you just organically go like, hey, this person could fit in this role. And someone like him is he speaks the language of the business language. So like when we're in there and we're meeting with so many people, especially when you're building a theme park, you're going to meet with everybody. He knows how to talk that talk and all. And then I can just bring the passion.
And I'm curious too, like, you know, with this movie. So, you know, You write your stand-up specials, you perform them, you're like kind of in control of every aspect of them. And I'm wondering, how does that compare to being in a movie where, you know, there's other actors, someone else wrote it, there's a director, there's all these other voices. Like, how do those two worlds, how do you like being in that world versus you are in control of everything?
Well, now I like being in that. I mean, it was awesome. But I wrote this with another writer, Dan Lagana. And I was a producer on this movie. So I don't now going forward, I just wouldn't ever do a movie that would ever put me into a position that would make me do something I'm not going to feel comfortable with. And I mean, fortunately, I've been able to get to that. I mean, I would have done a lot of that probably earlier, but I just didn't. It didn't work out that way. And so, you know, I now kind of go like, all right, well, now I've kind of built up into this thing where I'm, you know, I always think I'm in the ticket selling business. Like, so all in general of a lot of things, you're just selling tickets. You just got to get people to come to the thing that you're going to go do. And so since I've been selling tickets now with stand-up, it's like that's where that rolls into that theme park, that rolls into movies where I want them to go to theaters. I want to kind of somewhat keep that relationship I have with the audience where you buy a ticket to see me.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. You should, it seems like you got a good handle on this whole Hollywood thing, building
it. Well, it's, yeah, I mean, you know, I would always kind of jokingly say it's like you want help as you come up, and then you're just kind of like, well, don't let me, you know, if you let me figure it out on my own, then I'm not going to need you. So it's, you're kind of, your whole rise, you're just kind of like, well, someone help me.
Yeah.
And then when they don't, like, not that they don't help you for any right or wrong reason, but you just kind of start doing stuff and figuring out on your own.
Yeah.
And then you realize you have a lot more say.
You've done some pretty nerve-wracking things from where I sit, hosting the Emmys, Saturday Night Live. Like, how do you get yourself ready for those, you know, there are millions of people watching me and there's no do-overs, go.
I mean, just stand-up comedy. I mean, that's all stand-up is you're on a show. Now, you're not on the level of that, but it's, you know, I mean, there's been plenty of times in my stand-up where, like, I've started a joke or something and I kind of forget where I'm at, and you have to kind of get out of it and not really let the crowd know that you're lost, even in your own act.
Do you have a tell? Anything we should watch? Do you scratch your ear?
When I yank on it, I don't know where I go. I don't know where I'm at. But it's so you. I've just been through a lot of those situations.
Yeah.
And so you learn that, like, kind of train yourself, like, nothing can really go wrong. Like, and again, as a comedian, you're like, I can get myself out. Comedians are good at getting themselves out of, like, situations, because when you start, you're going through, I mean, just the worst shows. Three people are at a show. It's like, and you're doing it's like the first 5 years, 4 years, I mean, you're in front of like five people a night doing comedy. You know what I was most nervous about was on SNL was the stand-up, the monologue.
Oh, because really?
That was, you know, that's the thing you're supposed to be good at.
Yeah, so right.
that had the most pressure. The other stuff, I went into it that weekend and I just told myself, I go, just commit to everything. No matter how stupid you look, just commit to everything. And I just knew that actually I've done this a lot where I would tell myself, like, it's actually, you will look more stupid if you don't commit. So if you're trying not to look stupid and you don't want to feel embarrassed, well, committing is the only way to not feel that. If you go into it with a little hesitation, that's extremely embarrassing and stupid. And that's what you're going to be insecure about. So it's like, it's better just to go all out.
Right.
Then, you know, and then let it fall where it falls.
You know, Saturday Night Live, Washington's Dream, you know, it's in the pantheon of James Brown, Celebrity Hot Tub, More Cowbell. Like, it is an instant, like, you know, Lazy Sunday, all of that. And our show's editor, Henry, actually had a question for you, which was that doing the second SNL, following that up, does that put more pressure on you, or is it like, you know, a comfortable jacket? Like, I know this one works. Like, how did that all go?
Yeah. So Streeter Seidel and Mikey Day wrote it. And it was when I went back for the second time, I was like, are we going to do it again? Like, and, you know, I think they thought the same thing. And you just had to really think it through to be like, you're trying not to. Is it better to be this one-off kind of thing, or it could be another thing? But, you know, I think it's one of those where people like that format and they like seeing it. And so, you know, we did talk about it a lot of like, should we do it again? Should it just be like, it's over? what are they, you know, it's like, we did it, don't mess it up. But it was, it made it, you know, the second one was, you know, people come bring that one up. I mean, obviously the first one, first anything is going to be the top. But when people, you know, it's like, I think watching an old, like when you watch sitcoms or an old sitcom, and you, it's just a comfortable thing to watch and you laugh. It's like the idea of that is like people really enjoyed that character. You're not going anything too crazy far out.
Yeah.
It's the joke is you kind of know what the joke's going to be and you're just looking at other ways to do it. And so, yeah, I mean, but it was a big conversation.
If yeah.
We should do it again or not.
Well, I'm glad you did. And it's funny that the original one, I guess, almost didn't even go on. Right. Is that right?
Yeah, because the table read, it was just not good. Because I was not good in the table read. I'm used to live. I react to audiences. So again, I knew it would be good, but it was like in the table read, it, you know, it's like no one's really laughing. And so then it wasn't, it was like on the like maybe, and Lauren was like, I don't know. And then I just said, I go, I love the George Washington one. And so for the run throughs, he goes, all right. And he let us do it last. And then I couldn't even, like, to me, I'm like, yeah, this is going to be great. Cause once I have an audience, then that sets the timing and everything. And so once we did it with that crowd, I mean, it destroyed.
Yeah.
And then it moved up to like, I think the third sketch or something like that. And then it was like, oh, we got it. But yeah, there was a moment where it was like, you know, I don't know if it was going to happen.
That's amazing. It reminds me too, a million years ago, I worked at Jimmy Kimmel Live, and I remember some writer was pitching him something, and he was kind of like, the writer was like, I don't know, are people going to think this is funny? And Jimmy was like, well, look, I can only do what I think is funny. And if I think it's funny, I just hope that other people think it's funny too. So it reminds me of that, just like you had this confidence in it. It might not have played well at this moment, but trust me, let's do it.
Yeah. 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 And that's how you tell jokes. That's like when comedians sometimes try to help you write jokes. It's like really hard to take someone else's joke because you just know what you can sell. Like, it's like, even if the joke's funny,
mm-hmm.
you're like, I just can't sell it like you would be able to sell it.
Right.
So then I'm going to have no confidence in it. And then when I tell it, the audience, even whether they know it or not, they can tell you don't have confidence in it. And then the joke bombs and then you learn a lesson.
That's great. So switching gears a little bit, a lot has been written about you kind of getting into shape and getting yourself physically fit. And first of all, is that weird to read stuff like that about yourself? But second, I'm wondering, like, how that transformation, like taking care of yourself physically, you know, how does that affect your mental game?
You know, I don't know. I think sometimes I always thought like working out was like a luxury, like, you know, someone being a member of a gym or all this kind of stuff. I never, you know, I didn't play sports really growing up. I mean, I played like church basketball that I've talked about. I would play, but I never was like coached. And like football, where it's like all this weight training was like really ingrained in you. And so I just never did it. And, you know, but I'm realizing now that you do it. You know, I see it a lot with the CEOs I meet. A lot of CEOs, not every one of them, but a lot of them, you can tell. I mean, they're really, you know, in good shape. And they're you can tell that they take that priority. It's not like they're bodybuilders. So, I mean, some are, but. Some are just, you can tell that they consciously just try to give themselves the best energy for that day.
As long as you don't turn into one of those like jacked 65-year-olds, those are a little off-putting.
Yeah, not yet. Maybe, you know, I got time. I'll let you know. Like, no, I can't imagine ever doing it. I don't need to be jacked. We're looking, as I always say, I just don't want you to see my nipples through my shirt. No, that's. I'm just waiting for that day to come.
But what if that's the reason why you sell so many tickets, Nate?
Well, so what's funny enough is I would look at it as like that. I'm not doing myself a service if that's the reason. Okay. Like it's, you know, There was that was another thing I learned early in comedy was like when people had like a joke, like their hair was a certain way, or and that would be the joke was their hair. I remember just thinking like, I don't want to have to like have a certain haircut for the rest of my life. <You're right. laughs> Just to have a joke work.
Right.
You should be able to be adaptable. Right. And write other things.
Right. That's great. So we got listener questions on the show. And this one's going to be pretty wildly out of date by the time this episode airs. Full disclosure, we're recording this in February. But listener Chris Valentino asks, if you could win a gold medal in completely average skill, like folding fitted sheets or finding the end of a tape roll, what would it be?
A parallel parking.
Oh.
It'd be, I'm unbelievable. I'm unbelievable at it. In New York, my biggest achievement where the gold medal would have happened, I parallel parked and I was touching both cars.
Wow.
Yeah. And I got out of the spot. And I, and don't you dare, don't think I don't bring that up.
I was going to say, how long, that's at least 20 years ago, but still.
Oh, yeah.
This man has hosted the Emmys, Saturday Night Live, but that's one of the crowning achievements.
That's one of the biggest things I've ever done. I made people come out to see it. I made them, I made them walk over and I go, you got to see what I just did.
That's incredible. All right. Well, I don't want to keep you too long, so we're going to move into a quick little speed round. Are you ready?
All right. Yep.
So what is a habit that you are happy to have and one that you wish you could ditch?
I'm happy to have the habit. So my wife and daughter tell me be funny before every show. And that's been going on, you know, I mean, before my daughter, then now, till now. So that's a habit. That's a habit that I love, and it. I talk to them before every single show, and I talk to them every day anyway. But it's like I make sure, and they forget sometimes. And I'll call them, just be like, "I'm going on right now," and they're like, "All right, be funny." I'm like, "All right," and then I hang up. So that's a habit that I love. I say a habit that I don't. That I wish I had was just having more habits and structure. I don't think I do not have good structure. And with a comedian's lifestyle, you're kind of just not in a structured lifestyle because it was, you know, I was in Springfield, Missouri last night. I was supposed to be in New York today, but now I'm back here. And then you got to go to New York tomorrow. So you're just always kind of out and about. And structure is a big one that I wish I could work on. And really just and be in control of my life like better that way. So that's one that I know I need to have, especially to go forward business wise.
What is something that most people love but you secretly can't stand?
I don't like tomatoes and onions. I don't know how much they love them. I want to start a restaurant called No Tomatoes, No Onions. We have no tomatoes, no onions. And we even have spaghetti, but you can't tell that there's a tomato in there. I'll tell you that. It's blended down to the smallest thing. So that's the one that I don't love. What I do love is olives, black olives, green olives. I can eat out of a jar.
Yeah.
And that's always the one that sometimes people like are like, ugh. I like pepperoni and black olive pizzas. My favorite pizza.
Excellent. And then so finally, it's 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon. No one else is home. You're feeling a little peckish. What's the delivery order?
Oh, at 3? You know, it depends. It could be Firehouse Subs or that or McDonald's. I mean, a good 3 p.m. McDonald's during the day is, I mean, that's obviously when they're at their peak. This is when, you know, the A-team is in. So you want to take advantage of that. And so that's usually, you know, that's a nice, it's either Firehouse Subs our McDonald's.
That's beautiful. And as someone who, as a teenager, worked at McDonald's and closed it many nights, I'll definitely agree with you. 3 o'clock is your best. That's going to be your A team. The closing shift, not so much.
Yeah. It's when the ice cream machine is broken.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, Nate, it's been so awesome talking to you, and also just thank you for your comedy. I think everyone can agree. We all like to laugh and not be challenged about our political views and this and that, and just to like sit back and have a good laugh. So I know I appreciate it. Nate's movie, The Breadwinner, is out May 29th. Go watch it. Don't be the person who says they don't make good comedies anymore and then doesn't go to the movies when a good comedy comes out. Go support them. I'm talking mostly to myself.
Yes. Thank you.